You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Welcome to the Bridge to You podcast, hosted by yours truly, Monique Russell, where we focus on diversity, inclusion, and understanding for Black cultures through conversations that help us connect to ourselves and each other. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Bridge to You podcast. I'm your host, Monique Russell. And today, guess what? You are in for a treat. Dr. Camila Majeed has devoted her life to using wonder, humor, and insights to release trauma and deepen relationships in individual, family, organizational, and communal wellness. Her portfolio, let me tell you, is extensive, and her work is deep in gaining awareness of why we are the way we are, but more importantly, how to navigate and transform our patterns towards healing and liberation. Bridge to You listeners, my intention today is that you dive deeper into uprooting any divisive thoughts and behaviors you have towards each other, and that you're truly enlightened through Dr. Camila's own personal and professional journey. You're going to want to listen to this more than once. So get ready to take notes. She's an author, professor, speaker, where she's even shared her wisdom at the White House, universities, and organizations all around the world. I'm super excited to have you here on the show. Dr. Camila Majeed, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for that warm welcome. And I'm really excited to be here. I think what you've established with this podcast is so meaningful and contributive to Black communities and to all communities. It's really an enriching space. So thank you for having me here. And feel free to call me Camila. May I call you Monique?
Of course. Of course. Okay, so let's dive right on in. I know that your work is so deep and extensive, and I'm going to try and wrap this up really quickly for the listeners. So, your mother was your first spiritual teacher. How did she demonstrate spirituality to you?
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the extraordinary Layla Majeed. I have a picture of her right here on my desk, and I just, you know, she's beaming at me and so present with me, even now as an ancestor. She's just very much part of my viscera. She's part of my thinking. She's part of my feeling and sensing the world. And honestly, it was in her behavior and in her demeanor. Like, she just had a very natural regality to her, you know? So it's almost like there was no difference between how she was when she was praying and how she was when she was cooking, how she was when she was chanting and how she was when she was speaking to us. You know, my mother had a very soft kind of mellifluous voice, you know, and it just really conveyed that deep spiritual grounding that she had. You know, we grew up practicing Islam, and, you know, when I was about 17, she started practicing Buddhism, and I was like, huh, what's this? And, you know, again, it was the changes that I saw in her life. She was always kind of equanimous and peaceful. Yet when she started practicing Buddhism, she became like so much more bubbly, and she was doing more. She started doing more. She'd already been raising the six of us. And when she started practicing Buddhism, she went back to law school and, you know, earned her law degree and was working full time and was still just really full of this kind of energy and life force. She was like, yeah, Camila, you should try this chanting thing. I feel like I'm tapping into something different. And so, you know, it was really her behavior, the peace and equanimity she moved with, She was not a yeller or a screamer ever in her life. And then, she began to practice Buddhism. Just so much joy started emerging from her life. So I was like, okay, I'm down. I'm gonna try it.
It's amazing how, we can try a different way of living and being, and it unlocks so many different aspects of our personality or, like who we are. And I love when you talked about the fact that she was the same, or you witnessed her being the same, whether she was praying or whether she was cooking. Because a lot of us, it's like we have these versions of ourselves, these masks, if you will, what is shown on one side or the outside, which I think most people tend to have. And then, when we're behind that closed door, but if the people that are closest to you, your children, can observe you and see you as similar in all aspects, I feel like that is just one of the greatest gifts we can give to demonstrate genuineness and authenticity.
Yeah, she was extraordinary in that way. Oh my goodness. She didn't hide her tears, and she didn't hide her joy. She was just kind of straightforward. I feel like, our society has gotten really performative so that people, like you say, put on this mask. When she was with us, she was herself. When she was with anyone, she was herself. And whatever she was experiencing, now, does that mean that she, always showed her pain? No, she was very judicious, right? So in places that, were not safe places for her to show how tired or stressed she was, she was a Black mother raising six children. She knew how to, self-regulate so that, all the pain didn't leak out in places where it wouldn't be held well. But she didn't try to hide behind any facade of superiority or perfection as a parent. She was real. And that was part of the beauty of her, Laila Majeed is definitely, definitely still my primary teacher. And she was absolutely my first teacher.
Wow, what a blessing. That made me think about a story that you shared in your book, Joyfully Just, Black Wisdom and Buddhist Insights for Liberated Living. And there was a story in there that you shared about a man who he had the resilience and the patience to sort of potty train his son. He was fulfilling all the parenting tasks, but he had a business and he was struggling to get out of his comfort zone. And you advised him to reach out to one business contact per day. He was doing once a month. So once a day was like a big stretch. And the thing is that if he got a rejection, to reward himself for it. Now, I immediately saw that as, wow, this is a way to reprogram your mind towards rejection, because it's something that so many of us are afraid of, struggle with, don't want to experience. But what really, really stuck out to me in that story was when you then took that action or activity and then helped him to frame or create an affirmation that he could now use and embody to demonstrate to his son that he was having a trying and a resilient spirit. And I think that is the piece that was really, really profound was, wow, now I'm developing myself. How can I use an affirmation to support my new programming towards rejection? And then how can I now pass this energy, this spirit, sort of what your mom did to you, onto my son? And I don't know if you can remember what that affirmation was, but I would love for you to share that affirmation and that experience with the audience.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that I wrote this book was because I've been a therapist for 20 years now, and in addition to being an educator that trains therapists. And I just have so many stories. I was like, these stories, people could learn from these stories. So of course the client names have been changed to, protect people's identity. But yes, in the book, I talk about a client who, like you said, was doing, good job with the day-to-day work of parenting, potty training and so forth. But he was trying to grow professionally and just feeling very defeated about the rejections he was getting. And so, the first thing we had to do was, like you said, that reprogramming where we start to reward ourselves for when we are rejected, because the rejection means we tried, right? And it's so that we train our brains to stop thinking of rejection as failure. Rejection means I got out there and I made an effort. And rejection itself is a, you know, it hurts when it happens, but if we stop taking it like personally as a sign of failure, but rather as an opportunity for growth, then it has a different meaning. And one of the ways we can start giving it that different meaning is to reward ourselves, like, you know, do something nice for yourself, not like, oh, poor you, but like, congratulations, you tried and got a rejection, right? You submitted you submitted an article for publication, or you went for a job interview and you didn't get it. Yay!
Oh my God, that is like a complete mind shift. I'm even trying to visualize that, right? That is very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, and once you start doing it, then you learn to laugh at quote unquote failures or rejections. It's like, it's part of life. And you begin to lay the groundwork to having an undefeated mind. So the affirmation that I gave him was along the lines of, you know, saying to his son, you know, daddy didn't get, you know, the job today, or he didn't get the opportunity today, but I will never stop trying, right? Sometimes, you know, I often have encouraged clients to say the affirmation in the mirror or something like that to yourself, which is great too. But to say it to your child, that's like a transmission of intergenerational resilience right there. It's just like, feel me, son, you know, you will be powerful. We will be powerful even when we quote unquote lose, right? That losing is just a step on the in the process of living, right? And in the process of growing. So like, that's how we create intergenerational strength, intergenerational resilience, by welcoming challenges and difficulties as opportunities for growth. And by telling our young people, it's not always gonna go perfectly. Let the times it doesn't go perfectly be the times that you really reach for and cultivate that strength that says, I will never give up. Until my last breath, I'll maintain a fighting spirit to just win and be victorious in life. Because guess what? That fighting spirit is the victory. That fighting spirit is the win, right? And then your family, when you struggle, when your family struggles, if we're constantly, you know, talking to each other like that, then we develop a very positive and life-affirming outlook that just flows through our well-being and through our activities. And please, when you go out for a job interview or something like that with that kind of can-do attitude, whatever you're trying to do professionally, all of that translates in that realm as well.
Okay, so I love this because I'm really big on family. I'm really big on like doing the work to connect, because in my own life, there have been moments where I didn't feel like I was connecting and I was belonging and I was being understood. And I felt if only my people had the tools to understand, to demonstrate, to be and not just do, outcomes and families and unity and lives would be different. Your work is very transformative. I read where you talked about, you know, the importance of mindful speech and just really contemplative practices as a way to foster healing. What motivated you to pursue this line of work with mental health, with social work and activism?
You know, it's interesting because I realized that, you know, life is often at such a pace that we don't stop to experience what we're feeling or consider what we're doing, right? We just go, kind of on autopilot. And what I realized from my own practice, my own meditative practice, my own practice of Buddhism, and just my own practice of giving myself spaces for stillness, my practices with music, I talk a lot about Black music, I realized we can just create space in our life to live it at the pace of peace. Mm-hmm. I talk about what does it mean to live at the pace of peace? And that's what contemplative or meditative practices allow for. Now, you know, a lot of the notions of mindfulness are, let's say, conflated with a lot of pretentiousness about being serious all the time or about being deep. But for me, I really feel like meditative practices can be, and often are, certainly for Black people in our history, the music that we listen to, right? And sometimes that's jazz, right? The jazz has a very, creates a lot of meditative, contemplative space, but also other genres of Black music. Like if you think about the blues are people working with sorrow and suffering, you know? I mean, and it's so funny because with Beyonce, you know, doing this country album, it's like Black people have been doing that music like forever. Like we are definitely the innovators in that genre as well, because it's very related to blues, very closely related to blues, talking about the suffering and the struggle and, you know, the flooding in the basement and it ain't pretty. And, you know, we're singing about it. We're singing through our struggle. Like that's a contemplative practice. Like I sometimes lead meditations where I tell people, you know, make a little spoken word poem or a little song about what you're suffering through right now, because it transforms the pain into something creative, right? Something that you can use as a template for further growth. That's what the suffering is for. So if we start kind of having that viewpoint of suffering, it's not so heavy anymore. Instead, it's a font. It's a well we can draw from for ever, ever growing inner richness. So that's why the contemplative practice, the meditative practice is important, because it helps us to slow down and just reach for some of the richness that's within and all around us and connect to that. And it doesn't have to take hours. It could be 5 or 10 minutes. And if you think about it, a lot of times, you know, you're watching TV for, you know, hours and hours. And does it really make you feel better? Like one of the practices I have in the book is around, you know, being conscious as we're watching TV, right? Sometimes we'll watch TV to kind of take our minds off feeling bad. But what we're watching is so upsetting, you know, we don't even realize that our heart is racing from these murder scenes and violent scenes until we finish watching the movie. And it's like, you know, I really don't feel better.
Yeah, you just assaulted yourself. You literally just assaulted your entire nervous system.
Yeah. So the contemplative practice is, you know, about slowing down, being present enough to say, okay, what is my experience of my life in this moment? And what could I use more of to make it richer? What suffering am I going through? How can I navigate that suffering wisely and creatively, right? Just inserting it in our lives enough so that we're really awake and present in our lives. And I think, you know, there's very naturalized way to do it. I think there's this good book that some colleagues of mine wrote called Beyond White Mindfulness, because in westernized notions of mindfulness that draw from Buddhism, but don't name Buddhism as the source, it's just kind of like sit down, breathe, and meditate, which is good. It's valuable to sit down, breathe, and meditate. And the deeper part of the tradition that that draws from talks about interdependence and seeing your connection to other people, because that's what makes you feel wise and strong. Otherwise, if you're sitting down meditating, you could get in a bad space. You know what I mean? You could almost get it all in your head. It could be in a bad space, but to have the awareness, let the awareness of our interconnectedness with all people arise, let the wisdom arise about suffering, just is a natural part of life. And it's a doorway to growth, right? If we meditate with those ideas, then it has meaning, you know, and it opens so many inner doors, which in turn opens external doors.
External. I appreciate this part, especially about the interconnection and the interdependency, you know, and thinking through for other people, especially because, you know, this podcast, while we cover so many different angles, the mission is really about unity and diversity and inclusion among Black cultures. And so I think that a lot of times there is this division and this mindset of different and, you know, just not a connected feeling or understanding between Black cultures. And I wanted to know, what are your thoughts in terms of strategies that you found most effective for fostering understanding and change among Black cultures?
Well, it's interesting because I talk about this in another article that I wrote around overcoming internalized racism in Black communities and domestically, internationally. And, you know, The first thing is to recognize that the legacy of colonialism and enslavement, its intent was to really capitalize amongst differences among us and to create kind of a false competition and hierarchy, right? That's just what it's always intended to do. And if we can say, no, I'm not going to be bamboozled into that anymore, I will free my mind from that particular, from all of the legacy of colonialism and enslavement, but that one especially, the one where we were set up to be in unnecessary competition with one another, the one where we were taught this myth of scarcity. Oh, there's only so much. So any other Black person, you got to kill them if they're trying to get to it before you. You know, it's not true. It's not real that we're richer when we share, right? It's a very hard concept to grasp in a kind of exploitative capitalist context, but it's true. We have more when we have what we share with one another. Like, you know, the richness that you have to offer, me sharing my richness with that, us sharing it with each other, makes us both richer. But it's hard work, it's emotional work. Yes. That you have to kind of, you know, take care of that little person inside of you that's saying, no, I want it just to be me. I want it to be my name at the front of it. I only want to talk about me and my work, because if I talk about other people, then people will go look up their work and they won't be focused on me. It's like that little child in there that's afraid they won't get any. It's like, that's the child that we have to hug and say, you know, you're safe, you're loved, you're free. And being free means that you're not going to be harmed by sharing and having this open approach to, you know, supporting the work and the well-being of other people. That will only make you better and stronger. So, you know, as I sit here on this podcast talking about my book about Joyfully Just, Black Wisdom and Buddhist Insights for Liberated Living, I'm thinking about other Black wisdom teachers. I'm thinking about Reverend Angel Kyodo Williams, and I'll say her name. I'll say Ruth King's name. I'll say Kyra Jewel Lingo's name. I'll say, you know, the names of Angel Acosta, Michelle Chapman, who runs the Black Mindfulness Group. Because, you know, if I have a heart, that the doors of my heart are flung open in that way, you know, that I'm saying, look, there's many brilliant, beautiful, insightful Black teachers, then I'm richer and I'm enriching everyone around me. So, yeah, I mean, and it's work, though. It is work.
I was going to say, okay, this sounds great, Camila, because you are in the space. But now if I am one of my listeners is listening right now and saying, okay, but I have someone who you described in the previous part of that example working with me right next door. I don't want to go over them and give them a hug. I want to kick them in the face. How do I even work? How do I even begin to work with someone who is not in my family or not a loved one that I can, you know, say, you know what, I'm going to have a deeper commitment and work with this person. How do I even navigate in the world, when there's so many of us that haven't reached that level of awareness? And I'm not talking about you and I, I'm talking about, you know, the collective.
Yeah, right. I mean, well, the first thing that I'll say, obviously, you know, as a therapist, I'm not going to encourage anyone to kind of put themselves in a relationship or a context that's harmful and that's abusive, right? And unfortunately, some people aren't that far on their own wellness and insight journey that the only way they know how to be in relationships is to be, you know, negatively competitive and combative and maybe even abusive. So those people need a little time, and you need space. We need space from folks like that while they do their development work. And this can be the person next door in a cubicle to you, or this can be someone on a panel with you at an international event
who has a certain view,
like you Black Americans, blah, 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 right? Like I've heard that. And it's like, actually, no more than any other group can be lumped together. There is no such thing as you Black Americans, because there's millions of different iterations of us, and there's millions of different iterations of Africans and millions of different iterations of Caribbeans. So one of the things I do see happening, you know, working in various Black communities, I've done research and just worked in various Black communities all over the world, I see those kinds of dynamics operating. Oh, these people, you know, one Caribbean group, for example, saying this about the other Caribbean group. It's like all of that. And if I can just help people to kind of zoom out and say, actually, that's all information we learned from the oppressor. And you just singing their song, it's not even your song. You know, you're just repeating it. And the most important thing is to ask ourselves, is this worldview enriching me or is it making my life and world smaller? And if it's making your life smaller to think, oh, not those people over there, only these people, then why are you conscribing your life that way? But also to work on hurts, because sometimes we have been hurt by people of a certain gender, people of a certain ethnicity. So you have to kind of work through that to be able to see people of that ethnicity and gender more clearly, right? So if I've been hurt, for example, by a lot of Black women, or maybe just one or two, but it really hurt a lot, then it may be hard for me to see and trust Black women. And the work of doing so is so worth it, to not let that one or two painful experiences cut me off from the rich resource that is all Black women. Come on. Yeah. So if we can see it as, well, we have difficulties with people, make a decision. This is not going to define how I think about this group of people, especially Black people. Then we're freer, because we've got to be free within ourselves and also free amongst ourselves, amongst one another.
Yes, yes. That's why I'm so proud of this show, because I felt the importance of highlighting people, guests, Black leaders, experts like yourself, who are already living an awakened life of openness amongst Black cultures and openness amongst and within other cultures as well, because many of us do exist. And the noise that's in the market tells us that there's not a lot of folks that think this way. And that's also, I believe, a false narrative as well. There's something that you talked about that, when you said it, it made me think about this topic of unnecessary comforts in your book. You talk about the unnecessary comforts, and I think of it as a way to begin the smaller steps of building that inner resilience, of doing without, of sort of preparing us before we are able to look at suffering as something that we can embrace. I want to read a short passage of what you shared in that book. And it says, when we loathe suffering and unrealistically expect to have no or few painful circumstances, no or few, we increase our suffering by bearing it ungracefully. We become bitter, mean, cantankerous, and just plain miserable. The next time you find yourself suffering, notice the different ways that complaint and gratitude resonate in your body as you contemplate suffering.
It's really important. It really is, because two people can be going through the exact same painful experience. But if one has an attitude of, well, I'll have my family as support, or at least I'm still breathing. Maybe I have pain in every joint of my body, but I'm still breathing and I don't have any respiratory problems. And that's something to be grateful for. Then their actual physical sense of pain in their joints goes down, right? That there's a lot of studies that show that these kind of gratitude mindsets is itself has a neurobiological effect, so that you physically feel less pain when you're in a mental state of gratitude. But also, you know, your emotional state is dragged down by complaint, because you are pointing your mind and saying, mind, I want to point you only at the worst things. I will not point you towards anything that's going well. And why would we do that to ourselves? Why would we point our mind to like the pain of it as opposed to the possibility of it, right? Okay, I have a headache and the sun is also shining. You know, I'm having a generally good day. I had a good breakfast. I got a good night's sleep, right? And if we can make this become habitual, then the pain and difficulties of our lives don't control us. Mm. If we have a habitual practice of gratitude, a habitual practice of almost like anytime we hear complaint knocking on the door, we open it open that door and say, hey, but you know what I'm grateful for? Like, that's how we greet it, that we constantly greet the complaint person, you know, that comes up with gratitude, you know? It just becomes a, you make your own life and mind a nice neighborhood, a nice place to be in when you have that. You really do. James Baldwin in, I talk a lot about Black books because, you know, that's one of the things my mother had me reading. I was reading Maya Angelou when I was 7 and James Baldwin when I was 10. And, you know, there's this quote in Just Above My Head where he says, I realize in life, there is no complaint department. Like, ain't nobody taking these complaints.
No, they don't care. Then nobody's listening. Everybody has their own, like, return to sender. Seriously.
Yeah. And they do get returned to sender. And so we become our own complaint departments, just carrying all these complaints. It's like, don't let your life become a complaint department. Don't let your mind become a complaint department. Nobody wants to be in there, especially you.
Yes.
So to let our minds and our lives be gratitude departments, no matter what's happening, that's what it is to live an undefeated life. And that's the kind of joy I'm talking about in the book. I'm not talking about some kind of superficial joy where you're not present with pain. I'm talking about the joy that's so grounded in gratitude and wisdom that pain is interesting, noticeable, sometimes useful, but it's not a source of complaint.
It's
a source of wisdom.
I love it. I love it so much. Bridge, to you listeners, I already told you she was coming with the heavy, deep work, transformative and contemplative. Listen, I don't know about you, but the things that are popping out is, listen, what is the pace of peace? What is the pace of peace? If you have not taken anything from this conversation, get your journal out right now and write, what is the pace of peace? How can I match this? How can I move it? Music is meditation. If you didn't hear that, you know, you don't have to sit cross-legged with your eyes folded in the deep of the forest singing Kumbaya. You can listen to music and know that you are meditating. The thing about it is, you have to ask yourself, are these thoughts enriching my life or are these thoughts making me smaller? And I know it takes a whole lot of work for us to do it, but you can do it because I believe in you and I know you believe in you and we believe in you. Pain and difficulties do not have to control us. A lot of us have experienced very traumatic periods in our lives, difficulties. It's a part of life. It's not something to loathe. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's not something to complain about. But as Dr. Camila said today, greet the pain. Let our minds become gratitude departments. Be curious, notice, observe, and wonder, and make your mind a very rich environment and playground. Dr. Camila, if anyone wants to reach out to you, connect with you, follow your work, where should they go to find you?
CamilaMajeed.com. You can go right to my website and, you know, my email address, MajeedContemplativeConsulting@gmail.com is also a way to reach me. If you go to either of those websites, you'll also see the book, Joyfully Just, or you can go directly to joyfullyjust.com, which is a page on that website. And I just look forward to it. I love being in community with folks because, you know, I want folks to read the books, but I'm also creating lots of opportunities for folks to process the information. And on that note, I just want to kind of close with an appreciation of you because you mentioned earlier how there's a lot of noise about, you know, disunity. And what you're creating with this podcast is elevating those of us who are very, very much interested in unity and connection. And there are so many. So I'm excited for you and the continuation of this beautiful work that you're doing here.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of Bridge to You. Make sure that you go on Apple Podcasts, give us a review, 5 stars, you know it, and let us know how you enjoyed the show. All right, everyone, take care. And until next time, be well.
Thanks for listening to the Bridge to You podcast. Visit ClaireCommunicationSolutions.com or connect with me on LinkedIn, Monique Russell, or Instagram at Claire Communication Coach.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit MarketingPodcasts.net.